from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next hour of Forum, we talk for the opening half hour with local Vietnamese-American author and journalist Andrew Lam, who will join us in studio to discuss his new collection of short stories, Birds of Paradise Lost. Then we welcome famed PBS talk host and author Tavis Smiley back to Forum to talk with us about the poverty campaign he and Cornel West have been behind and his most recent book, Fail Up. Forum is next. Join us and join in after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Author Andrew Lam says he robbed his Vietnamese parents of their American dream the day he told them he wanted to be a writer and not a doctor. But years later, Lam's writing still centers on his Vietnamese roots. Lam joins us in this hour to talk about this half hour, I should say. This is an hour that's broken up into 2 hours to talk about his newest work, Birds of Paradise Lost, which focuses on Vietnamese immigrants and their struggles to integrate into the Bay Area. He's editor of New American Media, the country's first and largest national collaboration, an advocate of ethnic news organizations, and also the author of Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnam Diaspora, which won the 2006 Penn Open Book Award, and East Eats West, Writing in Two Hemispheres. And both those books were featured on Forum, and now we're having him for the third time here. And for full disclosure, Andrew was a student of mine over 20 years ago, which I'm quite proud to say. Also, we're getting former students of mine who are publishing fiction. A couple of novels have just been sent to me within this week, and it's kind of exciting to see. It's also exciting and good to have you back here.
I'm glad to be back.
You've been following immigrants now, particularly, mm-hmm. I mean, the immigrant story, not only Vietnamese, but Asian immigrants for
yes.
quite some time, as a journalist, as a writer. But here it fuses into stories.
Yeah.
And talk about the difference between that in terms of
yes. I mean, for 20 years, I've been writing essays and reporting pieces about immigrants and immigration experiences, you know, in California. But there are things that you cannot express through nonfiction because, you know, they're real people with real concern, whereas there are issues that they can no more tell you in public than they can tell themselves because they're too painful, too hurtful to talk about, especially refugees from Vietnam, from the war, for instance. And the only way to get into that is to really live, inhabit their private lives. And that's where the fiction comes in.
Well, this indeed gives us an inhabiting of private lives in a number of the stories. I'm particularly struck in many ways by the title story, Birds of Paradise Lost, because mm-hmm. It's about a self-immolation.
Yes.
And, you know, normally you think about Vietnam and self-immolations, you think about the Vietnamese War and
yeah.
Buddhist priests, but this is a man whose motives become very mixed and
yes.
unclear.
Yes.
Which is part of the fascination for a reader to yeah. to delve into that. But you take us into a real generation gap. And I wonder if this is characteristic. I mean, the older Vietnamese seem to feel in the story exceedingly vehement mm-hmm. in their anti-communism,
mm-hmm.
including that was initially the reason that was presumed for the self-immolation. And the younger Vietnamese Americans, including young doctor who drives a Jaguar,
mm-hmm.
Don't necessarily feel any differently, but they certainly don't view things from the same perspective
sure.
by any stretch.
Yeah, I think, you know, in my first book, Perfume Dreams, I addressed that generational gap. But in this one, I sort of imagine what it's like when it carries out in terms of death, you know, and this man who went to Washington, D.C. to set himself on fire sort of created a whole rift back in San Jose community because people sort of become divided between those who are for that kind of action and those who are against that kind of action. And certainly the younger person who talks to his father on this issue is against it. He's a doctor. He doesn't want people to set themselves on fire.
Especially his father, who seems to suggest that maybe
that he would do it too. Yeah. yeah. And I think in some way that is the rift between approaching Vietnam as well. Do you approach it with logic or do you approach it with just emotion?
Well, the young doctor says logic, and of course his father mm-hmm. says emotion, and there's a split right there. And it's a universal generation split in many ways.
And it is. And in some way, it plays out in Birds of Paradise Lost in, you know, various stories because, you know, for generations that belong to my parents, Vietnam owns them. Vietnam still owns them. History has a way to sort of run backward for this generation. For my generation, we still are defined by that history, but we no longer by being owned by it. And so we kind of take our trajectory forward. And I think in some way, it plays itself out in very personal ways, in families, in communities, and so on.
Well, the father in the story, we find out, for example, I'm not, I think, giving away too mm-hmm. much here, both his parents were killed by the communists.
Yes.
So there's that kind of mark in the consciousness.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to let go of vehemence. I mean, people who are defined by war, I mean, Vietnam vets, people who are traumatized, they become sort of defined by the violence that that marked them. And in some ways, so many can't go past that wall. And for me, doing fiction is a way to open up a window on the possibility of letting go.
The father, at one point in the story, toward the end, blames America for what's happened to his son. I mean, it's a process of assimilation that any ethnic group goes through. But, you know, in other words, somehow he feels his son has abdicated and given up his ideals and so forth. And what I was struck by in that as a reader, was thinking about the Vietnamese people, whether from South or North, and in particular, I suppose, of North, but both— not blaming America. I mean, in many respects, you hear about people going to Vietnam and they say so much welcoming, so much feeling and emotion toward Americans. And Vietnamese Americans are very proud of being here in this country. And yet you would think what America did in Vietnam would cause much greater enmity and much greater anger.
Yeah, it's kind of an irony, but in Vietnam, people are very welcoming, in part because Vietnam's population is 90 million. When the war ended, it was less than 30. So that means 2 out of 3 have no memory of the war. So the vehemence is not really there anymore after 37 years. In the United States, however, the population that came, they tried to preserve certain values, certain history, and the younger generation break free from that. And so they blame America for stealing their children because they watch as their kids speak English rather than Vietnamese. They watch as they become more individualistic and less Confucianist, you know, behavior, you know, less family and more liberated. And so the blame in America for the diaspora is about America stealing their children from their cultural mores.
Again, we're talking with Andrew Lamb, who has a collection of short stories all called Birds of Paradise Lost. Want to talk about that title, Andrew?
Yeah, it's from that that short story we've been talking about. And when this man, who is the narrator of the story, found out that his friend had gone to Washington, D.C. and set himself on fire to protest.
His friend, who we should say is the editor of a San Jose
newspaper. Yeah, of a newspaper,
Vietnamese newspaper.
Yeah. And so what happened was, when he looked at a photograph that a tourist managed to take, and the flame reminded him of the flower called Birds of Paradise. And I thought, so interesting because it's both beautiful and horrifying, you know, and it sort of struck me as a way to build a whole story out of that image. And so that's why I stuck to it in a way.
Also, using fire here. Yeah. I mean, in fact, fire is at the center of the story in some respects because of the self-immolation, but as an element that can purify and bring martyrdom, but also is terribly destructive and so on.
Yeah, it also rage and anger, right?
Yeah, passion of all kinds.
Yeah.
You use a quote of Mamaday's here, anything is bearable as long as you can make a story out of it.
Yeah.
That's kind of your ethos?
Yeah, it has always been. You know, as someone who left Vietnam at the end of the war but was lucky enough to not be a boat person and flown out of Vietnam and then went on to my American life, went to Lowell and then Berkeley and, you know. It was a way of feeling, I mean, writing becomes sort of my way of dealing with my survivor's guilt because you know, nothing bad happened to me, but so many bad things happened to my people. And I watch on the news, you know, boat people were dying on the high sea, holding flags saying SOS and so on. So, it would become a kind of exercise for me to pick up the pen. And this is where I broke my parents' heart, because, if they couldn't tell their story, maybe I could tell their story. That was the seed of my writing.
Are they more accepting of you as a writer now? You think they're well, still lamenting that you didn't.
Yeah, well, they still lament, but you know, there is this funny thing about them whenever I win an award, I give it to my parents, and though I don't see it, people tell me that there's this obligatory walk that newcomers who come visit my parents are asked to come by this mantle where my awards are, and they will say, these are Andrew Lamb's awards, before they sit down and pour them tea. I guess they're proud.
There's much to be proud of. You've had a lot of success, and congratulations
for
all of that success. Which brings up another question, because when you mentioned the boat people,
There
was always this sense that, I'm sure you've heard these stories, many of our listeners have heard these stories for years, particularly remember the boat people coming here. You've had extraordinary success, but so do many of even those who came here as boat people.
Yes.
And there's something in Vietnamese culture, you know, you'd hear these stories of somebody came here with no skills in English, and graduated valedictorian class 2 years later.
It's extraordinary. I think there is a way in which the Vietnamese protected themselves even before they got here, because of the people who left before come back and say, look, you know, I was there just 10 years and I own a company already. So people who came later already imagined themselves being successful. It's almost like a mythology that continued to be built upon. And I have friends who were deprived of education in Vietnam but continue to study at home so that by the time they get to the United States, they can catch up. And one of them actually didn't go to high school but taught himself and then got into City College and then got into Stanford and became a surgeon, having skipped 5 years of school in Vietnam. That kind of willpower is quite something, I think.
It's a kind of Nietzschean willpower, maybe, but it's also culturally a fact about Vietnamese wanting to succeed and being driven and being ambitious and also being very scholastic.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's the only upward mobility in Vietnam, even during the Mandarin time under the royal families. It's like the Confucian Chinese imperial system. The only way to move upward back then is taking tests and become a Mandarin if you pass, you know, and it's very difficult, but everyone wants someone from their village to make it because then the whole village could be proud. I mean, if you ever go to Vietnam, the most beautiful temple, I would argue, in Hanoi is the Temple of Literature. And it's beautiful because, you know, everyone goes there and pray, they keep it up, and then the people who pass and become Mandarin, their names are etched onto stones, you know. So there is this sense of achievement that is almost like a super sports stars in this country.
Our guest again is Andrew Lamb. Let me, this is going to be only a half-hour segment, so let me open the phone line. Some of you may have observations to make about Vietnam. I also want to talk with Andrew and with you, our listeners, about hybrid identity, because Andrew has said on a couple of occasions that what he's looking for is that, E.M. Forrester would say, only connect, you know. He's read a lot of Rushdie and Naipaul and Edward Said and feels that, you know, East and West can meet and there can be a hybridized identity, a Vietnamese-American identity, for example, and it's something that indeed should be nurtured. Let's hear from you. And in fact, if you have something you'd like to contribute here, we welcome your calls right now. Toll-free number 866-733-6786. Please feel free to call us and join the conversation if you have some observations or if you have questions or comments. Again, toll-free 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website and you can post questions or comments there or join the conversation by going to the website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also go to our Facebook page or communicate with us by tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll go right to calls in just a moment. I want to especially hear from some Vietnamese Americans. But what about that bringing of the two together? I mean, you've had a lot of thoughts about
this. Yeah, I think all literature that is serious deal with the question of who am I, you know, and
for identity.
Identity. And who, you know, I, you know, a lot of my work has been about trying to approach an answer because, you know, for an 11-year-old kid who didn't speak English, only Vietnamese and passable French, suddenly is plopped from his world and put it in another world and asked to speak English only and take a new name and a new way of life. Of course, it's a little bit of a shock. And so
a little bit of a shock.
And so a few years later, you know, that question of like, who am I exactly? Why am I speaking English and not Vietnamese? And, you know, why am I behaving this way, no longer that way? All those things become sort of prevalent in my mind, you know, so...
But there's so much you want to preserve, even in these stories.
Yes.
You know, all of the details, the rituals, the type of food, what you drink, the family and how it operates.
Yeah. But, you know, for me, it's no longer a question of preserving, but how to make that culture alive in America. Because you cannot really preserve culture that is functional in another country that is no longer functional here. You have to adapt and change and transform and tweak it a little bit. I mean, you see how food is changed form here. You know, the Vietnamese sandwich is called banh mi, is now on like Food Network, but it is transformed because it has to sort of cater to the new palate, right? So preservation can only keep it as a one form, but I think a real live culture is when it's sort of mixed in with the new one, use the local ingredients and then transform itself into something that can bridge between cultures.
Again, we're talking to Andrew Lam, and let's hear from our listeners, and let's begin. Jennifer, with you. Good morning.
Hi. My comment question is for Mr. Lam. I'm ethnically Vietnamese and born in Houston, and my family, or my mom anyway, does not like talking about Vietnam, and I think based on kind of the research and questions I've asked other family members, is I think her family was from the north, and they were refugees by plane, not by boat. I think in order to get a spot on the plane, I think there was probably deception, murder, all sorts of other things. I wanted to ask you, you know, what your knowledge is or your impression. There seems to be a lot of animosity between Vietnamese refugees that go on to France to get maybe their PhDs or higher degrees versus boat people. What's the relationship there and what's going on?
There's different kind of hierarchies. I mean, you have that in every community. In fact, I still go to Vietnamese wedding, and the first question people ask me is, when did you come here? Because that sort of mark how far you have integrated in this country. And if you say, oh, I came here before the war ended, everyone looks at you as if you're so lucky because you didn't experience the horror of the end of the war and the refugee experience. If you've flown over, you're not a boat person, you're a plane person. If you're here long enough, of course, you're established. You didn't miss schools in Vietnam and you continue. So there is all this sort of like a hierarchy that plays itself out within the Vietnamese community. And then the division between North and South. I mean, because we had a civil war and we have had civil wars for over 200 years on and off, there's a lot of vehemence between the North and the South. And so there are all kind of divisions. But the reason why Vietnamese parents don't really want to talk about their past is because it's painful.
Some of it's really traumatic.
Yeah, it's traumatic stuff, and you can't really bring it up. And so I've given talks at universities where a lot of Vietnamese-American kids come up to me and say, thank you for telling me this or writing this book, because I have more insights about my parents than I have had all these years living with them, because they don't talk about what had happened to them.
And I thank you for the call, Jennifer, and I want to bring on another caller, and that's you, Steve. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about a student that I had at Berkeley who fits some of the things that Andrew's been talking about and completely disagrees with him in one other way. She was a boat person. Her family came over, eventually got to from Thailand to Los Angeles when she was in junior high school or seventh or eighth grade, something like that. And her father said, you're a girl. You don't need any more education. And she defied her family, left her family, became a ward of the state because she wanted to continue her education, and eventually got to Berkeley, graduated from Berkeley, and went to Harvard Med School. So it's kind of she has the incredible steely resolve that you've been mentioning, but I hadn't realized that there could be such a big difference in gender.
You know, I'm a little bit surprised by that because a lot of families I know encourage both daughters and sons to go to school and to achieve as much as they can in this country, especially when education is mostly free until college, you know. So I'm surprised
maybe they didn't have enough family income or something.
I don't know. Yeah. So it must be a very particular condition in which she found herself in. But education is a big emphasis for both male and female here as well as in Vietnam.
And Steve, we thank you for the call. And let me go to another caller. Tom, that's you. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good show, Mike. And thanks, Michael, and thanks for taking my call. I remember, at least my own memory, that the monks and some nuns, Buddhist nuns as well, were immolating themselves in Saigon, not to protest communism, but to protest the American puppet government, the Diem government.
That's right.
And there was actually a big feud or even a war going on between the Roman Catholics in the cities and the Buddhists in the countryside. I think
But Andrew's turned it around here. He has an American Vietnam, as I said, editor of a paper in San Jose, self-immolate, in, at least ostensibly, according to the note he leaves, in protest against communism. But, of course, he's bankrupt. And so, like I said, the motive gets murkier as we get into the story.
So it's actually a religious war. It started out as a religious war, then quickly became a war against communism to get American European support.
But there are a lot of self-immolations in the United States by Americans who protested the Vietnam War. So it's not as if one person who self-immolated in Vietnam has the same motive as someone who does it in the United States.
United States against the war in Vietnam, like Kent State and other students who were brutalized and murdered by what we called the hard hats back then, right-wing supporters of the war, because it was a huge cash cow moneymaker for the blue-collar workers who work for the defense industries. You can read about it, you know, Daniel Ellsberg's book.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Although Kent State was pretty anomalous. I mean, you know, it didn't happen all over the country. Let me get Fai on. Good morning, Fai.
Morning, Professor. Good morning, Andrew.
This morning.
Fai on.
Hello.
I'm glad that you wrote the book and talk about our Vietnamese problem, but I haven't read this book yet. I read all the other books and other essays. But I think the hybridity and the parent complaining or blaming America for stealing our Confucian culture is not all true, because some of the parents, I think, are glad that their children are more individualistic, but in a way, you know, the hybridities hurts more when they, as you said, don't dwell on the history, especially, you know, the political underpinning that put a lot of them here in America.
And not only the political underpinning, and I thank you for the call, I think as you were pointing out, it's the trauma and particularly the hardship and often, you know, getting strafed with napalm and going through those kinds of experiences of wartime.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, in Birds of Paradise Lost, I look at the trauma and how it it's inherited even when you don't know the exact narrative. Because when your parents suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome, it affects you even though you don't know what had happened to them. So in a way, you know, we all inherit trauma even when we don't experience war.
And again, Andrew Lamb's new book is Birds of Paradise Lost, a collection of short stories. He's also editor of New America's Media and country's first and largest national collaboration, and advocate of ethnic news organizations. He'll be appearing this evening at 7:30 at Booksmith, and Friday from 6 to 8 at the California Historical Society, and March 21st from 6 to 8 at the Mechanics Institute. I think we got it all, Andrew.
Yes.
Good to see you again.
Thank you,
Michael. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
When we return, we're going to talk with Tavis Smiley and find out about his ongoing attempt to campaign against poverty. I'm Michael Krasny.